You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today, we're opening up air purifiers in West Hollywood at Adrienne Vinson's house. She's been selling them for 25 years. Right now, she's showing us a couple of her products.
This gets the smaller parts, the smallest of particles. This is for carbon.
And Vinson has been getting a lot more business lately. That's partly because of the pandemic. But September, the beginning of wildfire season, has become a big month for her.
Because that's when people line up to get machines because they can't breathe.
2021 is on track to be California's worst wildfire season yet.
You know they're going to be here. In the past, like 10 years ago, I didn't think it was that big a deal to make sure I had plenty of stock for fire season.
With more wildfires comes more smoke and more health problems. That's why NPR's California Newsroom partnered with Stanford University's Environmental Change and Human Outcomes Lab. Together, we examined more than 10 years of federal satellite images of planet Earth. And we counted the number of days with smoky air in every zip code in America. It's an investigation we're calling Dangerous Air. KQED's Farida Jobvilla Romero worked with KCRW's Kaylee Wells to understand what's happening. And Kaylee starts us off with a story all too familiar for many Angelenos.
Arlene Fleck lives in Irvine, where we found the number of smoke days has tripled to 30 days every year. She says when it gets bad, she has a hard time breathing and gets headaches.
It's gotten to the point where we have fires so much that even like when we have fog, I'm like, okay, is that smoke now or is that fog?
Last year, Fleck evacuated her home not because of wildfire, but because of the smoke that seeped through the walls of her home. Our analysis found the number of smoke days in Irvine was pretty typical for Southern California. In LA, the average days of smoke per year jumped from 9 to 32. The smoke was especially incessant in Malibu and Brentwood, home to some of the most destructive fires, and Castaic, which is a rural community surrounded by dry brush. But Fleck says even that isn't as bad as up north. She had to shoot a movie in Stockton recently, and she said the ash falling from the sky was great ambiance for her horror film, but not great for breathing.
It was pretty rough while I was up there, and I felt so bad for them. I'm like, how do they do this all the time? Like, for us, you know, we have them, but it's nowhere like it has been up there.
Our analysis found people in Stockton breathe wildfire smoke for 60 days every year on average. And in the northern part of the state, where wildfires have been the worst, some communities are exposed to smoke for 90 days. Farida Jobvilla Romero picks up the story from a school 2 hours north of Sacramento, where playing outside is increasingly a luxury.
Longtimers say sports events anchor the town of Willows, 100 miles north of Sacramento. At a Friday junior varsity football game in this town of 6,000, cheerleaders shake their gold and purple pom-poms.
K-I-C-K, kick that ball! K-I-C-K, kick that ball!
Thick haze covers nearby mountains in this part of the Sacramento Valley as megafires burn in Northern California. When there's too much smoke in the air, schools cancel outdoor activities like football. But today...
Today's better, obviously, because we're playing the game.
Stacy Lancey has two teen sons, one of them a student at this high school. She's also a third grade teacher and says the bad air quality is affecting students.
As far as like kids going out to recess, playing sports, and kind of like an overall health, we don't know why we're having headaches and runny noses.
Headaches, runny noses, and a myriad of more serious health problems have all been linked to breathing wildfire smoke. Willows endured more than 3 months of smoke per year on average between 2016 and 2020, making it the smokiest place in the state. Millions of Americans are also breathing a lot more smoke from western wildfires, an impact felt from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. That's according to an analysis of a decade of federal satellite images by NPR's California Newsroom in partnership with Stanford University's Environmental Change and Human Outcomes Lab. In a small town like Willows, physician assistant Brett Brown regularly treats patients at the hospital's family clinic. When there's smoke in the air, he sees more patients suffering asthma attacks, intense migraines, and stress.
There's always somebody who says something about, well, because of the smoke, insert, you know, problem here, whether it's I haven't been able to breathe as well because my allergies are so bad, or I haven't been able to see my mom and dad because of COVID, and now I can't even go outside, so my mental health is so much worse.
Children are more sensitive to dangerous particles and wildfire smoke because their lungs are developing. Since this scale of wildfires has never been seen before in modern history, we don't know much about the long-term impacts. And that has parents like Brown worried.
So if you let your kids play outside during smoke days, what's going to happen to their lung capacity or their cancer risk? We don't know what that data looks like yet.
At Murdoch Elementary, hundreds of students pour out of classrooms and play with balls and hula hoops during recess. It's a good day, but Principal Miguel Barriga doesn't take this recess for granted. When the air quality reaches levels the federal government says are unhealthy, Barriga has to keep students inside all day. And that's tough for some kids.
You know, we'll end up in the office, acting out in class, get emotional one way or another, or want to go home.
Like other school administrators here, Barriga monitors local air quality reports constantly during wildfire season. He says he wants better forest management and solutions to climate change so fires don't burn so intensely.
You want to believe that the decisions at levels higher than ours are going to be made, will be made to make it be more normal.
More like it used to be, he says, when you could go outside and not worry about breathing wildfire smoke. I'm Farida Javala Romero in Willows.
All of this smoke is also having an impact on kids here in Southern California. Ed Aval is a founding member of the USC Children's Health Study, which has been monitoring how air pollution affects children for decades. And he says smoke can infect everything from the lungs to the brain.
Everything from, you know, difficulty breathing, obesity, diabetes, other sorts of diseases, abilities to pay attention, ability to stay on task, behavior in classrooms, older individuals, issues of rapidity of development of dementia and related symptoms, Alzheimer's and problems.
NPR's California Newsroom combed through years of healthcare data to learn more about the impact of wildfire smoke. Here's what we found. There were 30,000 more hospitalizations statewide for cardiac and respiratory illness between 2016 and 2018, which at the time was the worst fire year on record. Some of the biggest spikes occurred in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties, where the Thomas Fire burned. Between 2016 and 2018, hospitalizations shot up more than 10% there.
There are more days of smoke exposure having to do with primarily with the climate change, but also with these wide swaths of fire that go on for weeks and weeks. And so the exposure, the long-term exposure, is one of dramatic concern for us, you know, in the public health community.
The landscape here means fire burns fast and it's hard to control. But the good news, if you can call it that, is that fast fires means less smoke in the air, which is why most of Southern California is looking at a month of smoke per year compared to 3 months up in Willows.
The fuel load is much greater in Northern California because of the type of vegetation they have.
UCLA environmental science professor Michael Jared says the fires here usually burn dry grasslands and shrubs. Northern California has big, tall trees that burn a lot longer, releasing more smoke for each acre burned.
So when those large trees start to burn, they put off more emissions. And although we do get very severe wildfires in Southern California, the fuel load, if you think about it on a per acre basis, is much less. Oftentimes, it's less than a tenth of what you would see if you're up in a very large forest with a lot of broadleaves and the needle trees.
Plus, much of Southern California includes desert and urban sprawl, so there's not nearly as many flammable acres as up north. That's why out of California's 20 largest wildfires ever, only a quarter have been in Southern California. But that doesn't mean the health impacts here aren't serious. Once the smoke comes, experts say the best defense against smoke is closed windows, air conditioning running, or, at the very least, a filter taped to a box fan can help some. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. LA County District Attorney George Gascon says his office is dismissing some 60,000 cannabis convictions. That's in addition to the tens of thousands that his predecessor, Jackie Lacey, expunged. Now, the cases under Lacey came from California's State Department of Justice. Gascon says his office found more by combing through LA County court records. Felicia Carbajal is executive director of the Social Impact Center. That's an LA-based community center that, among other services, helps people with convictions go through the process of getting them dismissed from their records. Felicia, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
What kind of offenses are we talking about here, Felicia? How far back do they go?
I mean, I'm not privy to any of that information just because of privacy factors, but in conversation, we were told that some of them have dated back all the way to the 70s.
Wow. Back when Jackie Lacey was the district attorney and she dismissed 66,000 convictions, that was the number, she was reporting that about a third of those folks were Black, one third. 45% Latino, 20% white, which pretty clearly shows, you know, who's been most affected by these kinds of convictions, right?
Absolutely. I mean, when Black and brown communities say that this was an assault on them, we have the data to be able to share, just like you shared.
It's right there.
Right. It's right there. I mean, it's numbers. The data doesn't lie.
What is the effect on people who have these convictions removed from their records? I mean, I assume that you don't have to check the box anymore, right? When you're applying for a job.
Well, you don't have to check the box anymore, but that was a different legal provision. But with that being said, there are still barriers to housing. There are still barriers to employment if somebody decides that they want to do a check. There are still barriers in education. I mean, in the state of California alone, there are 5,000 barriers that individuals who have criminal convictions on their record experience. And nationally, there's 48,000. So there's a lot of barriers. Folks don't even recognize that, you know, if you're a mom or you're a dad and you just want to do PTA or be able to go with your kids when they go on a cool field trip, those are the simple things that folks are prevented from being able to do.
How do you find out if your conviction's been expunged? Do they send you a note? Do they send you flowers? What do they do?
Well, nothing really happens in terms of notification because of those privacy laws. So what the public needs to do, or if you have a friend or a loved one who believes they have this type of conviction, is that you need to reach out to the DA's office, you can reach out to the public defender's office, or you can reach out to us at the Social Impact Center, and we can get you some community-driven support, which just means that we will be that bridge and kind of lay in on the various offices to get us information and to put you in the right path to be able to get that necessary information.
I want to talk more about Proposition 64 that was passed in 2016. And you know, since then, the big legal industry has been growing around the cultivation and sale of pot and pot products, which is a huge business here in the state. And It's kind of a cruel irony that there are people now making a lot of money off that business while others have been dealing for decades with having these convictions on their records, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's almost shameful to see an industry blossom in this capacity and to see this portion of the process, the repair, the campaign marketing that specifically said was going to ensure that, number one, people didn't get arrested, which that is what we in fact have seen, and then automatically expunge these records, which we're still waiting across the country or across the state to see.
These expungements, by the way, they're all of pot-related convictions, right? Are there other types of convictions that can be expunged or reduced? I mean, how do people find out if they qualify for that?
Well, there are other convictions that, I mean, expungement isn't limited to cannabis. So we've had Prop 47, which was passed, another voter initiative passed in 2014 that afforded folks with, again, low-level, nonviolent offenses, drug-related and some additional offenses to have them expunged as well. So how to find out if you qualify? Oftentimes, you can show up to the city. You can reach out directly to the public defender's office. They've made a pledge at yesterday's press conference to help anybody and everybody who reaches out to their office to get assistance.
Your organization is called the Social Impact Center. You're going to be doing more of this work out in the community today, right? I mean, tell us how you go about this work.
A lot of work. Today we're actually going to be out in the community and providing just basic information for folks. Tomorrow we'll actually be working in partnership with the Public Defender's Office, providing folks with legal resources, of course, and some additional resources. So when we think about folks who carry criminal convictions and who are looking for redemption, we think about their whole person. So a lot of the stuff that we do, like today, we'll be doing some breath work and some stretching, along with diving deep into what does expungement look like, what is record sealing, what are the potential pathways that people can navigate to get some forms of relief. So yeah, we do a lot of that. I mean, tomorrow we'll be giving out backpacks in South Central and food. And then on Saturday, we'll also be in the Valley doing a brake light clinic, which just basically means is we have some technicians who are going to help folks who have, you know, burnt out brake lights or a busted taillight and just provide the community with that service so that they can avoid contact with law enforcement that oftentimes leads to all of these barriers that we're talking about.
Yeah. Even a brake light or you know, a parking ticket or having your car towed can be the first in a long list of terrible things that can happen, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, fortunately, there's a lot of programs. People just don't know that they exist. I mean, the city attorney, the LA city attorney actually has a program specifically for what you're talking about in terms of the parking tickets and things of that nature that are just the moving violations. And most everyday people aren't aware of any of this.
Felicia Carbajal, Executive Director of the Social Impact Center. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great one.
Well, moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, Steve Chiotakis here. Scroll through Instagram or TikTok or Facebook, and there they are, ads from creators and influencers. They're telling you to buy tea to boost your metabolism. They're telling you about hashtag van life. They're telling you about clothes and makeup, getaways, even vitamins. This new economy of creators is booming, but the transparency of how to make a buck peddling those products, not so much. Enter the platform called FU Pay Me. You know what F stands for. It's all about helping creators figure out how and how much to charge for their influence. Their tagline is, quote, "Your bank would never accept exposure as payment, neither should you." And Isha Mehra is the co-founder of FU Pay Me, based here in Santa Monica. She's with us right now. Hey, Isha.
Hello.
So first off, bear with me. How does an influencer economy even work? I mean, say I have, you know, a couple, several thousand followers, and, you know, this brand, maybe an athleisure brand, wants me to advertise a couple of their products. They would offer me money to post about them, right?
That's correct. Brands will offer free product, they'll offer money, and then they'll have a set of deliverables that they want the influencer to post, whether that's three Instagram posts and two stories, whether that's creating a video for to either post themselves or to send back to the brand so the brand can post it. But there's always an agreement that they come to.
Does the number of followers you have directly correlate with how much money you can make, or are there other factors involved in all of this?
There are a lot of other factors involved. And in fact, what our data that we've collected shows is that follower count usually isn't a very good indicator of how much they'll actually get paid. I think it has to do more with what the composition of your following may be and what the brand's budget is. It's all kind of a black box. I don't think brands quite know how much to pay each of their influencers, and influencers don't really know how much to charge for their running their own little media companies, in a sense. So the payments right now just really all over the place, which is why we're hoping to collect all that data and kind of make it more transparent.
So explain how your platform works.
Right. So right now our platform is a web app, and influencers can sign up. They leave a review for a brand they've worked with in the past, whether it was a free product that they had to post about, whether they were paid $10,000 to make one video for them. They post about a review of a brand they've worked with, and then after we accept them into our platform, they can go read the 3,000 other reviews we have from influencers, and they can also kind of filter them by, I'm an influencer that talks about cooking, and I like to post on Instagram, and I have 5,000 followers. Who are other influencers like me working with?
How many creators are using it right now? I mean, what kind of numbers do you guys have?
Yeah, we have 2,700 users on our platform right now, and we have 5,000 on our wait list waiting to get in, and we have reviews for over 2,000 global brands.
You know, part of the issue, Isha, is that there are pay discrepancies. I would imagine, since there's not a whole lot of transparency here in the first place, that some folks, and I'm thinking race and gender here as well, some folks get paid more than other folks. That's got to be true, right?
That is absolutely true. There have already been a lot of articles about the pay discrepancy between women and men, but our data shows a huge pay discrepancy between different races, especially Black creators get paid the least across YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, for the exact same follower count or exact same deliverables. That's what we've noticed.
So how do you address that? What do you do about that?
Right now, we want to encourage more communication and transparency between creators. Right now, there isn't a huge way to know, oh, I should be advocating for more pay for myself, unless you know that there is another creator out there who was able to get that pay. And we also are encouraging social media platforms actually building these products to also make sure they're keeping race in mind when determining the metrics of success. For example, YouTube and Facebook, which have algorithms that decide which posts are shown at the top of your feed, they should make sure the metrics they use to determine success for their products aren't accidentally leaving behind. And I worked as a data scientist at Facebook for 2 years before this, so that's something I think about a lot.
How big, Isha, do you see the influencer economy getting? I mean, you know, there are a lot of people who kind of roll their eyes at all of this, right? Like, do you get that? Do you understand that people are just like, oh, geez, another person trying to sell me something?
Absolutely, yeah. We think the word influencer itself holds a lot of weight, and to us, this might be sexism issue where influencers are primarily women and their work is kind of diminished. But we don't see the influencer creator economy going anywhere. Already, there are over 50 million creators monetizing based on the content that they create. And in the future, we think that everyone will continue to become a freelancer working for themselves. And we think it's just going to get bigger.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. I mean, it's a fascinating story, and it's where we are with social media. Isha Mehra, co-founder of FU Pay Me. Isha, thanks.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, a trip to the May Company department store on Wilshire Boulevard. It's now called the Academy Museum. You may have seen it or passed by it there at Wilshire and Fairfax. An homage to the movies and to the history of Hollywood with a giant sphere out back. Reuse and renewal, a common architectural device these days, come along with us tomorrow. We're able to do the reporting that we do with your help, your support to this public radio station. You know, KCRW's good old-fashioned pledge drive, and we call it that because we're back to the basics. We're trying to raise the money we need to operate this public radio station. It wraps up tomorrow, by the way, the pledge drive does. So let me say that again. It wraps up tomorrow, which means your support today is so vital, so important, these final hours. We haven't yet raised what's required to keep KCRW going, so give now if you can. If you've been procrastinating for the past couple of weeks, you've heard us asking for your support, and you said, I'll do it. They're almost finished. I'll get to it later. Well, now is later, okay? It's time to give to the radio station that you use. Put a dollar value to it. How much does Greater LA mean to you or the music? If we can raise $25,000 by midnight tonight, you'll unlock an additional $25,000 too. Thanks to KCRW board member John Aoyang and Lori Aoyang. So thanks to them as well. KCRW.com/give. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help make the show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.